sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, sahaviryam karavavahai, tejasvi navatitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
How do we know that there is no non-existence? That has to do with the definition of terms. Like, for instance, if we say, what do you mean by the truth? You have to have a definition of what you mean by the truth in order to understand. Otherwise, that word's just an amorphous word, and you're kind of just filling in what you think we mean by the word the truth. So the definition for, for the truth, what we mean by it, satyam, or paramarthika satyam, absolute truth, is that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. So that which simply is. There's no negation of what is. So that's something which is without being able to negate it in past, present, or future. That's the definition of satyam. So now the definition of non-existence, which in Sanskrit would be asat. Asat, which is that which is, takes sat to mean existence. Asat, the unnegates it. That which has no existence is non-existence. And so this word asat for non-existence can be used in two ways. It can be used to mean mitya. Mitya is something we experience but has no independent existence of its own. That means that it's only the sat, being itself, that is existence, and a sat is totally dependent upon that existence for its existence. It has no existence. So mitya, in a sense, has no existence, but we experience it. And so since we experience it, we don't call that non-existence. We say it is mitya, right? That it has a dependent existence. It depends upon, we experience it, but its being is really satyam. We experience it, but its being is satyam. The other way that we take asat is what we call tucham. Tucham means absolute non-existence. There is no experience of it either. Mitya, you have the experience, but its being is only satyam, that which is existence itself. But what is tucham, or absolute non-existence, it can't be experienced because it is not there in any way whatsoever. You know? And so they use examples for that, which were usable at the time. Like, for instance, the son of a barren woman. Now, a woman now can be barren and she can still have a child, right? So, or the horn of a rabbit. They use that, but one of my smart alecky little students sent me a picture of a rabbit with a horn in it. the idea was that such a thing has never existed and can never exist. So that's an absolute non-existence. So, in order to even conceive of what we mean by non-existence, you actually have a definition of it, and the definition logically negates any possibility of such a thing existing, right? Otherwise, how do we know there is not such a thing as non-existence? Well, in some ways, there's conceptually non-existence. We have the word. You can imagine as though non-existence, but in terms of a reality, all that is there is the vritti of the imagination of non-existence, which is illumined by the sat-chit, which exists, right? And so there is no thing that can be viewed or understood or experienced which we can label as non-existence. The instant it can be experienced, it would be mitya. So, again, it depends upon your use of terms. It's a good question because actually this kind of question could almost apply to anything, and it's going to come down to whether or not how you define the word. And if you can define the word in such a way that that there cannot logically be anything that we call non-existence, because that would negate the meaning of the word. That's what I would say.
Can I tag on here?
Sure.
About unmanifest condition.
Yes. Now, when we're talking about, there's two, in the Vedanta, there's two levels of unmanifest condition. So the word in Sanskrit is vyakta. For something which is manifest, it's vyakta. It means you can experience, it's there, it's manifest, it can be perceived, it's a namarupa of sorts, name and form of sorts. So that is manifest. The first level of avyakta, where in Sanskrit the a negates the vyakta, avyakta, it is unmanifest in terms of like maya, or in terms of like your thoughts. Like I bet you're probably not thinking of a 1950s Cadillac right now.
Mm-hmm.
But if I bring it up, that may be in your knowledge bank somewhere, right? But it certainly, I really don't think it was in the room at this moment, you know? And why did I even think of that as an example? But anyway, I did. So I brought that into the room from an unmanifest condition for all of us. Nobody, not even me, was thinking of that until I did. So that means that this knowledge that comes into manifestation was lying dormant, ready for an opportunity to come into manifestation. So that type of unmanifest condition is what we call really maya. So when we say maya, we're talking about the prakriti, or the unmanifest that goes, becomes manifest, and then goes back to unmanifest, and becomes manifest, goes back to unmanifest. So maya itself, just the sattva, rajas, and tamas, the three gunas of maya, you know, are in unmanifest condition naturally until they manifest. So that's the first level of unmanifest. It's not something that's available for your experience. It's lying there dormant, ready and waiting to become manifest. Now, there's another level of avyakta which will never become manifest, and that is the atma. The atma is what it is, but it is never going to become a nama-rupa, a name and form of any kind which can be objectified and experienced in a subject-object relationship. So it is eternally, timelessly, unmanifest. And yet there's no ajnanam, there's no possibility of it ever becoming manifest. It already is self-evident, self-effulgent, right? But it can never partake of any type of subject-object relationship. So that's the absolute avyakta. So that avyakta, of which is Brahman, which is the Paramatma, which is the self, is always there in an unmanifest condition, illumining the maya, which goes from avyakta to vyakta to avyakta to vyakta, from unmanifest to manifest, back to unmanifest to manifest. So there's these two levels. And where that becomes really... There's a verse which just delineates, just as I've just delineated it, in the Mundaka Upanishad that actually labels. And there's a verse that delineates these two avyaktas, one being yourself, which can never be objectified as an object, and then the maya, which can be non-objectified in unmanifest condition and then become manifest. That's what we have to say about it.
Does Ishvara become unmanifest, or Ishvara Srishti? I don't know if you
want to... Ishvara... When we say the word Ishvara, what we mean is Brahman taking into account this incidental attribute, or this mitya maya, this maya which has it as its order of reality, mitya. It means it has no being of its own, but it... its home is Brahman. There is no other place for it to be. And so when we say Ishvara, we're acknowledging maya. And so the maya is what comes from unmanifest to manifest to unmanifest to manifest. Now, when we're talking about the whole maya upadi, the whole maya, not just the little jivas that are part in maya and suffering from the ajnanam of maya, but the whole maya. So even for Ishvara, when the maya is in unmanifest condition. That would be because there's no ignorance. That would be like nirvikalpa samadhi for you as a jiva. If you pull your mind in, if you resolve your mind just into the Atma, the mind is still there, right? But there's no ajnanam. There's a vritti. It's called an ati sukshma vritti, a very subtle, very, very subtle vritti, right? Which is there without any type of externalization. By that I mean, say right now I'm having a vritti. My eyes are open and I'm aware through my sense organs of all of the sounds and whatever is taking place. Right, so that vritti is now illumined by consciousness. So nama rupa, the name and form in the form of this room, is now a thought modification in my mind, which is illumined by consciousness. So now, say instead of my utilizing my sense organs, say I'm meditating, I'm doing nitta dhyasana, and I'm resolving my buddhi, my mind, turning gently, like I'll say in the contemplation, gently focusing, just gently focus on your own presence, your own being. Now when you're doing that, the content of the mind, of that vritti, is the one who's illumining it, is the consciousness. It's the very self, the very adhishtana of the mithya vritti, right? I'm turning my mind, focusing my mind on the subject, on the self. And so now I have the self, the conscious being, which is self-evident knownness, shining upon or illumining, we can say, not as a verb, but just like the sun is not illumining the earth, thinking I'm going to illumine the earth. If the sun is a luminary, and so the earth is illumined when it's in its orb, right? When the sun is shining upon it. But the sun isn't doing any activity, right? It's other than just being itself. It's not doing, let me shine on the earth now. So the Atma is not saying, oh, let me take a look at this vritti, right? let me illumine it. No. It is the self-evident conscious being, which is always exactly the same. Whatever vritti, thought modification, comes in, that is going to be illumined, because that is the very nature, that self-evident knownness is the very nature of the self. Now that mind can meditate. That buddhi can meditate, or you can look outward, it can do many, many things. It can think, it can contemplate, it can imagine, it has all kinds of things it can do. One of the things it can do is to kind of change its focus from any type of internal or external objectification. Like I could be focusing on my thoughts, or focusing on my ideas, or focusing on my emotions. That's where I'm turning my attention. But I could also, well, how I like to say it is just gently focus on your own being. And when it's doing that, there is no experience of an objectification, because I'm not looking in that direction. So my focus is just on myself, on consciousness. Mm-hmm. When that's the case, then the subject matter of the vritti is the very self of the vritti, which means at that time the vritti as though erases, it's there, but it as though becomes very subtle, not even experiential as an object, because it's focused on the subject. So at that time there is no experience of a subject-object relationship, even though that vritti in a very subtle form is there. Its content is no different, it's not other than the subject. That's called nirvikalpa samadhi. Nirvikalpa samadhi means there's no subject-object differentiation experienced at that time. Nirvikalpa means a duality, is experience. Nir, there's no experience duality, no subject-object duality. The only way you can have that is if the nature of the subject is the nature of the, is the focus of the mind. Then the subject is illuminating the subject as though, and so that vritti, which is full only of the subject, is not really going to be experienced. It becomes overwhelmed by the nature of the subject itself. The stock example they use for this is like holding a candle flame up to the sun. If you hold a candle flame up to the sun, then the sun and the candle flame having in a sense the same essential nature, the candle flame gets overwhelmed by the sun, even though it's still there. The outline is not even discernible. Like if you can discern, say you're holding a candle flame up to the sun and you can see there's the flame, there's the outline of the flame, and there's the sun, okay? But the content of the flame and the content of the sun are the same, you know, right? But I can see the outline. That's called subhikalpa samadhi, right? Because you're still aware of the candle flame, even though it has the same content as the sun. Mm-hmm. So say if you're meditating and your mind is just beautifully resolving into just conscious being, to consciousness, into your being, into the self. But there's still some awareness of that mirror of the mind, which is now just filled with your own being, as though, as in terms of content. But, you know, you said, oh, you're aware of your mind, which is totally absorbed in yourself, but that outline of the mind is there, right? And that subhikalpa, that's what we call, sa means with vikalpa, with a duality, because you're still aware of the mind. But if that's held for any period of time, and I mean like milliseconds or seconds, it will turn into nirvikalpa, where the nature of the self just totally overpowers that vritti. So that there's a knowledge that takes place there. You can have that type of nirvikalpa even looking out at Ishwara, because you recognize that there is nothing but mithya, there is nothing but conscious being and namarupa, mithya, a mithya namarupa that has for its content only conscious being. That's a type of samadhi, looking outward. Mm-hmm. Normally when we're talking about nirvikalpa, there's no vikalpa at all. It means the only thing that I'm experiencing is just Brahman, and it's not an experience. It's not a subject-object experience. That resolves, and it's just me, non-dual conscious being.
So how would you distinguish that way you described Sevikalpa Samadhi from Sahaja Samadhi?
In the Drik Trisha Viveka, they use the term Sahaja Samadhi. I should look at that because I need to look at Drik Trisha Viveka because I get them confused sometimes. There's three or four different samadhis,
but it's really like everywhere the mind goes, there is samadhi. It's not like you're getting rid of anything, and yet
that's what I was just talking about.
Yeah,
if there's even we would say now, I'm always, you know, speaking as Ignani, I'm always in samadhi because there's no time when myself is not there, or is covered, or is not present. And so in fact, I am always in samadhi because I am always here. You know? And then when myself is present, I mean, I like to say it becomes as dominant in the mind. My own being is dominant in the mind. Then the namarupas are nothing but Ishwara. And so that's sahaja samadhi. Then the thing is, what happens for a person is some kind of desire rises up. Mm-hmm. As soon as some desire, I mean, some sort of binding desire, not just a mithya, okay, but what we call a more binding desire, if that rises up, immediately the jiva pops up, you know? And so then the sadhana is when that little jiva pops up, you know, I want this and I need this to be happy. If I can't go on, if this is going to happen like this, there's just no. That's the little head of the jiva popping up. And well, that should be like the little hand raising, time for some sadhana. Let me bring my mind back to myself. Yeah. But that those occasions become less and less and less. And whatever desires come up are mithya, the non-binding desires. Those desires are perfectly normal as long as you have an upadhi, as long as you're exhausting the prarabdha karma. Sometimes the exhaustion of the prarabdha karma takes place in the form of desires. But still, they're non-binding because there's nothing in you that is saying, oh, if this doesn't work out, you know, I'm just not going to be a happy person. That's a binding desire.
Mm-hmm.
No. But I have a desire, but I don't have any such feeling that it really has to work out in order for me to be a whole, happy person, then that desire is Ishwara. It's prarabdha karma. It's not an issue. So I think that's the sahaja samadhi. But they have several different samadhis, so I'd like to look in the book and see what they're talking about. But I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
So it's more of a like recognition rather than objectification of the self, of Atma.
Yes, recognition is a better word because that non-objectifiable self-evident self is ever-present.
Mm.
It's never not there. And so it's always been there, you just haven't recognized. We say recognize because it's always been there, but you haven't differentiated it from your experiences. You know, so say you're having a sad experience. Then I am sad. I, the Atma, am now sad. But the Atma is there, and if that is the self you're referring to, but you're referring to that very same self, but through the lens of the emotion or the lens of the experience. You know, so your self gets labeled with these superimposed experiences. But as that viveka, that discrimination takes place, that superimposition becomes less and less possible. And so you're always you, you know, your being is always there in its true form. That's where the aham lands, is on you. And your body, your mind, your sense organs, and the universe, all from their standpoint, you know, enjoy the conscious being, which is you, the existence, which is you, from their standpoint. But who you are, they're dependent upon you, but you're not dependent upon them. And that viveka is very clear.
Mm-hmm.
That discrimination is very clear. So you're always there in exactly the same way. And so as emotions arise or situations arise, they arise, but they don't cover you. You're there. And you're there in exactly the same way. But these emotions are there, the situation is there, you know. Your body is there to be, you know, dealt with.
So, would you say then that the person, the jnani, is experiencing, you know, sense perceptions of whatever sort, but the interpretation is Ishwara?
Yeah.
Instead of the interpretation being basket or, you know, I mean, not that you wouldn't still know it was a basket, but I mean, that the focus, that the mind's interpretation is more that it's Ishwara than the distinguishing things about these different objects.
No, you still distinguish all the things about all the different objects, but your mind wouldn't be superimposing your raga dvesha on it.
Uh-huh.
You still see all of the distinctions, all of the depth, all the knowledge, intricate knowledge that you happen to know about it. You still see all of that, but you'd see all of it, all those details, but it wouldn't be encumbered by the projection of Jiva Srishti on it. So it's just the objective Ishwara.
Uh-huh.
But there's no lack of clarity.
Yeah,
in your sense perception or your knowledge.
Yeah,
I mean
yeah.
External.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does that imply for the intimacy with other objects if it's all partaking of the same being that we are?
Well, our minds are different, our bodies are different, our sense organs are different, our instincts are different. I mean, we all have the same. We all have individual sets of sense organs, but all of them are sense organs. We all have different bodies, but all of them are bodies. We all have different minds, but all of them are minds. And so they all have a way. We're all human beings, and so we have ways of relating with ourselves. And we have different ways of relating with animals. So all of these relationships remain. All the relationships remain. It's not like you have knowledge and then all these relationships are gone. They're not gone. They're absolutely here. But your ananda, your well-being, your wholeness is not at stake. But it's not that there aren't, okay, the prarabdha karma, there's going to be your family, your loved ones, your friends, you know, the flow of your life, the path that you're, of unfoldment that your life goes through. You know, but your relationship with them as you gain knowledge is a little different. They're allowed to be as they are without you freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean, you know, Swamiji used to say that the best person to be married to would be a jnani, because they can allow you to be as you are without their happiness being so much at stake, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so you also have much more freedom to love, because it's hard to really love somebody, to really care about somebody when they could leave you or hurt you or destroy you. But if it's fine with you for them to be who they are, because your ananda, your well-being, is not so at stake, you know, then you really have the freedom to love and to kind of objectively enjoy a person as they are. And if you need to make some adjustments in your relationship, you can do that without, you know, without losing yourself or without being so much at stake.
Yeah.
It's true with friendships also, you know, because you have just a lot more ability to let a person be as they are and be interested in them as they are without having to change them so you can be happy. I think, why did I get stuck with you? Stuck with you because you're so such a bad partner for me. but what if you can be whatever you are, and you could even go if you think that's what's best for you? I can accept that and not lose myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not projecting the ananda. The ananda onto you. You become the carrier of my ananda. That's a pretty big thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you better behave yourself, because you're carrying me around with you, you know. And I see you're abusing it in one way or another.
And I want you to be in a particular way as I wish you to be.
Yeah, so that I can maintain my happiness. Nobody's going to be a very good carrier of ananda for you. They just actually cannot do it.
Mm.
They can't do it because they're not your appendage, and they can make all kinds of subtle little mistakes, not on purpose even, you know.
Mm.
So, but what if you're not asking them to be the carrier? What if it's all right? What if you just feel happy to be able to be with that person as they are? It's a totally different thing, that type of objectivity. Swamiji always uses that word objectivity. I think it's a good word. It means the word, when we say objectivity, it means that you can actually be with the situation as it is and respond to the situation as it is, not just from jiva srishti, not from your raga dvesha, means your likes and dislikes, your desires. I want this so I can be happy, that's raga. I don't want this so I can be happy. That's dvesha. And so say when that comes in, you know, then there's this whole other thing happening, other than just being objective and dealing with the situation that's there.
Could you talk about objectivity toward the mind?
Objectivity toward the mind is really nice also, you know, because... We worked on that a little bit in the meditation this morning. In the end, the best way for that, the best maybe way to really express what that objectivity is, is for the buddhi to know your own nature, who you are, to have gained that knowledge, not intellectually. Intellectual also, but I mean to really know yourself, to be with yourself, to sit in yourself, so to speak. You're the self that you are is so free of fear. It doesn't cause fear. Yourself doesn't cause anybody fear, and it doesn't feel fear. That's not its in its nature. That's not its nature. And so it's also very accommodating. You know, it doesn't, it's not full of reactions. It's non-dual. So I'm just talking about pointing these things out as though it could be otherwise. It can't be otherwise. It's just its own nature. And so it accepts you. It accepts everything as its own being, as its own self. It is absolutely non-threatened. And so when the buddhi is coming, speaking from yourself, then it's truly an inner friend. It's objective. It can be with that experience, you know, from the standpoint of what your nature, from the standpoint of your nature, which is totally non-violent. It totally has no inclination of any kind toward violence or harm or fear or rejection. It has no such. It has no such possibility. And so when the buddhi is situated there, then the way that it will react to the thoughts of the mind and is more like Swamiji would say, like, how can I help?
Mm.
You know? Mm. How can I be helpful? Not let me change you, or let me do this, or let me do that. Mm. You know, it's how can I be helpful? And so that's really the nature of the self is the truth of the inner friend. And the buddhi is speaking from that vantage point. And when the buddhi, the mind, is speaking from that vantage point of the self, then there's love and acceptance and that attitude of just how can I help and objective toward the situation, not wanting to have any inclination to hurt. You know?
You mentioned with the word kindness.
I was just thinking that abhayam, that non, the ahimsa, the non-injury is negative, right? Non-injury. But the positive would be like kindness. That's your natural expression. Other types of expressions, negative expressions, are because of your own fear or your fear of something being able to hurt you or take something away from you. And then all these other darker emotions come. Mm-hmm. But when you don't have any such fear, there's nothing to evoke those emotions. And so the attitude you have toward your mind is the attitude you have toward other beings also. It's more just how can I help or what do you need and that type of thing. And if it becomes more, if it's a violent reaction, then there's more stuff involved. The buddhi's not coming from yourself, it's coming from a complex or some hurt or something.
Mm.
And so now you have to go behind that one also and kind of understand and be kind to that one that's not being kind. Because that one's also having trouble. You know, some kind of complex is there.
So they all partake on all those different levels of the self. Evident love. Like the mind enjoys love.
Well, in the
end, subject object thing going on.
But see, with the, it depends. Like your mind or even your buddhi can be talking from an identification with a complex, you know, or with an emotion. It can be talking from the standpoint of the hurt. Or it can be talking and experiencing the world from the standpoint of the anger or whatever. Right? And so that buddhi is overwhelmed by that emotion or by that little inner child or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's overwhelmed and speaking from that vantage point, right? But for the jnani, or as you gain knowledge, the buddhi is more and more just speaking from the vantage point of me, of the self that you are. And then that person's a very nonviolent person because the self is so nonviolent. That person is a very positively said, very, can be very, very, very kind because the self is kind, if I put it is in a positive way. It's dangerous sometimes to put it in a positive way because it seems like the self is doing something or has an emotion. But the positive emotion that comes from having absolutely no himsa, no potential for injury or for evoking any kind of fear, and the positive way of saying that is a person that has kindness, is kind. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I love the Dalai Lama bumper sticker. You know, kindness is my religion. Because there's, from the standpoint of the buddhi, that's active. A way of relating in the world or in terms of a value. And also, it's a word that we recognize when we're not kind. You know when you're not kind. And so, then that unkind being unkind butts up against your higher value of being kind. And so that word kindness brings is a sadhana that rises its head, so to speak, when you are falling short of that in your own mind. Then that sadhana will kick in, but that's not how I want to be. Mm-hmm. You know? And that doesn't have to be judgmental at all. It shouldn't be judgmental. Because we do all kinds of things we don't want to do, but we're working on them. You should be very happy that you're working on them. But just think, if Trump was working on some of these things, you would give him so much room. Look at this guy, you know, he's got these things, but you know, he's really working on it. It's really, yeah, really working on it.
You know? Hard to imagine.
He might be.
Well, I don't think so. But he could be.
He could be.
But he could be. Give him the benefit of the
doubt. Yeah. I keep waiting for like an Instagram photo of Obama to come out, like him in front of the White House in a yoga pose. You know what I mean?
Trump's like an archetype that we can. He's like the caricature of some archetype, you know. That we can kind of use. It's not very nice to do that, actually. It's not very kind. But it's amazing. In fact, talking about that, you should just go back in Bhagavad Gita with Swamiji's commentary and read chapters 16, 17, and 18 where he gives literally hundreds of examples of rakshasas and asuras, the demons, you know. And then Shankara, in his commentary, says, you know, we're not talking about these examples because we want you to be like that. We're talking about all of those examples so that when they rise up in your mind, you know, you'll recognize them as something that you want to work on. You know? But he does go through examples that to this day you can recognize in yourself and in others and in the world. You know, there are the examples of the demonic kind of rakshasa, you know, selfish, power hungry, greedy, grabbing behavior. But he goes through so many examples of it so that you'll be prepared to deal with your own rakshasa, you know, the inner rakshasa and the inner asura. Oh, there's that asura there. You have to do something about that. Let it be a deva. The asura is more tamasic, the rakshasa more rajasic, and the deva more sattva, where the sattva is dominant in the mind, or the rajas is dominant, or the tamas is dominant. Anyway, that's just a way of categorizing some of these ways. And the rakshasa, rajasic or tamasic behavior causes pain, causes agitation and pain in the mind. For the sattva is shanti.
For jnani, are all of those recognized as ishvara on the spot by any chance?
More and more. But when they're not, that's a little sadhana raising. There's a beautiful verse in the Gita. I said I'd have to look through the whole Gita to find it because I don't remember what chapter. Maybe chapter 6. I don't remember. Maybe it's chapter 3. Let's go through all of them. Anyway, so Krishna says, it's almost like he's saying, well, in any case, everything I've said, all of this is just talking about the mind and the way we are relating. It's only the actions of Prakriti. It's only the Prakriti. It's only the activity of Prakriti, the Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, taking place. You know? It kind of gets rid of all doership in an interesting way. It's just the play of Prakriti, the Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. I should find that verse, and we have to do it in the context of the verse. It's very, really beautiful, though. Not taking so much responsibility for the Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas behaviors of your mind. You're responsible for Shama and Dhamma. As a mumukshu, as a jnani, that those tamasic vrittis or rajasic vrittis that come, that you can let them just move on their way, you know, or if they get lodged in you, you can, you know, hold them and not act them out. Like, for instance, say somebody does something and you have a real strong reaction to it, you can practice Dhamma, you know. Dhamma means you've already been caught in the reaction, but with Dhamma you don't have to act on it. You can be really angry at somebody, but you have a value for not spewing your anger over everybody, you know. As you're not a spewer. You're not a spewer of anger. See, but you have it. It's not that you don't have it, but you know how to contain it and then take a walk and not, you know, not act it out. It takes some strength, you know. Means you don't have a value for being unkind or, you know, angry or scary. You have a value for not doing that. So even if it arises in the mind, your values can hold on to that and process it internally without spewing it all over the place. That takes, you know, consciousness. And a strong value, because otherwise it's gone. But that's okay. But say you still have the value. Say, okay, I missed it that time. Next time, I'm going to try to catch it before it just escapes. And then I do things and say things and behave in a way that is hurtful. I don't want to do that. Oops, did it again. Oops.
Yes.
Did it again. But that's okay. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. It's like, say you're practicing scales, and every time you're practicing the scales, you hit a wrong note. In this particular scale, it's hard. You continually hit the wrong note. Oh, okay. Try again. Okay. But eventually, because you're working on it, you can do the scale and you never hit the wrong note. But what if you hit the wrong note and then you said, oh brother, I can't do this, that's it. Yeah. I'm an angry person, I'm just going to be an angry person. If you don't like it, then don't come around. Okay?
And the best example of what you've been saying in the last 5 minutes was Swamiji.
Wonderful. Yeah. You really have. I don't even know. I'm sure he had some Dhamma that he had to use, but after a while the Dhamma has done the trick and the problem isn't there anymore, so you don't have to use the Dhamma because your mind just doesn't behave. You've cut new grooves in your mind.
So what's Dhamma?
You know, in the what we call the Sadhana Chatushtha, a group of fourfold really qualifications for an adhikari, a student who is attracted to Vedanta or attracted to self-gaining self-knowledge. There's four major attitudinal qualifications. The three of them are just one thing. It's viveka, just being able to discriminate, and vairagya, a certain type of dispassion, and mumukshutvam, a desire for liberation. But the third one is called the samadhi shatka. It's a group of three, beginning with shama. So it's shama, dhamma. These are the two we're talking about. Shama, dhamma, upadati, titiksha, samadhanam, and shraddha. So shama, these first two, the shama is as the mind, you know, thoughts and feelings and whatnot are just floating through the mind, passing away, you know, associative thinking. And you have a choice as this thought flow and this emotional flow is coming through, whether or not to grab onto it. If you don't like the thought or it's one that's not worthy of getting engaging in, you just let it go. That's shama. That you have control over whether that thought you're going to go with it or not. Sometimes the shama breaks down, right? And the thought or the emotion grabs you, it like gets you, and you're stuck with it. And now you need dhamma. Because when you're stuck with it, like say for instance, it's a deep hurt or an anger or resentment or something, but you've got it, you know. And then that creates what we call pressure. And it's a pressure to strike out. And so it's your ability to hold that pressure and work with it in a different way internally, without having it just overwhelm the mind and body and strike out in verbal abuse or in physical abuse of some sort, emotional abuse. You know, you're able to not let that overwhelm your buddhi. That's dhamma. And so say sometimes we fail at that, because if we never failed at that, wow, your mind has antikarma shuddhi, there's no problem. So we're all failing at that. but we shouldn't call it failure. It means it's like hitting the wrong key when you're practicing the scales. You know, in this particular instance, that one is hard for me to hold, so I'm going to practice it more. It's not that we're... It's not really a failure. Swamiji doesn't even like us to use that word, failure. Because it's not a failure. Unless, if you think, oh, I don't do everything perfectly, look at how much I've failed, you know, that is really depressing. It's not the word to use at all. It's not a failure. It's that I'm working on these things. I have these things, you know, that I'm trying to work on so that I can reach this level of care or kindness or whatever. I'd rather have my behavior be more in value, resonating with me. And when my behavior and my mind is resonating with me, that's all Ishwara. There's no jiva there. There's just Ishwara, really. Because it's a total manifestation of the self. That makes sense. Oh, it's getting late now.
No, what's tomorrow?
Maybe.
Please expand. Keeping focus on the viveka, to see discriminate the self from mitya. Okay, we'll be doing this. I'm not going to answer it now. We'll do it in meditation. Good question. But I'm tired. We must all be tired. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Om Swasti Prajapat Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimadishaha Gopramane Vyashubamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale varshatu parajanyaha prithivi satyashalini Deshoyam shobaragidaha Brahmana santu nirpayaha Om sarve pavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve padrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukha bhagavet Asato ma sagamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gunapyo Namaha Hari Om.